Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is impeachment week. However you want to spin it, either Nancy Pelosi is changing her tactics or is caving in, but she's going to be sending the articles of impeachment over to the Senate, which will have to decide what to do. And I think this is a good thing because it means we're going to have the focus back on, number one, whether we're going to have witnesses, and number two, the actual substance of the charges against Donald Trump. But in any case, it does set up what will be an historic trial before the United States Senate. Now, speaking of history. Now, we're joined by an eminent historian. I want to introduce him in just a moment. But I'm looking at Twitter because this is, of course, where we get all of our wisdom from. And somebody's pointing out that right now, today, we are as close in time to the first episode of the TV show Cheers as Cheers was to World War II's D-Day invasion. And we are as close to D-Day as D-Day was to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. So I want you to think about that. It just the scope of history that, you know, I was around. I remember when you know, Cheers began, and of course D-Day seemed like ancient history, and I'm sure that for folks on D-Day that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson seemed like ancient history. So speaking of ancient history, we are very much honored to have as our guest today Edward J. Larson, who was in the Bulwark last week talking about checks and balances. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, but it sounds like you'd rather have Norm Peterson.
No, I definitely have you. Okay, so I want to read this biography. This is impressive. Edward J. Larson received the Pulitzer Prize in History for Summer for the Gods, the Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. He is the co-author of Modern Libraries, The Constitutional Convention, and Narrative History from the Notes of James Madison. And he is the author of The Return of George Washington, Uniting the States, 1783-1789, and A Magnificent Catastrophe, The Tumultuous Election of 1800, America's First Presidential Campaign. And he is out with a new book forthcoming, Franklin and Washington, The Founding Partnership, which is really an unusual book because I never really think of Benjamin Franklin and George Washington as kind of the historic pair, but they were kind of the odd couple, weren't they?
They were good friends, though. They had become good friends during the French and Indian War. So they went back, just like you used your analogy, for people back then, they went back to the equivalent of the World War II. They had each been in charge, led their troops for their respective colonies, Pennsylvania and Virginia, which were then overlapping with both had claims to the Ohio country, which is what the French and Indian War was fought over. And they were colonels, which was the highest rank you could get in the New World. They were in charge of their troops, one for Pennsylvania, one for Virginia. They worked together in that operation. Actually, Franklin turned out to be probably did the better job, but then he was older and he was so clever and got along better with the Native Americans, who they were the opponent. But they got to know each other quite well. And later Franklin proposes him to be Washington to be head of the troops during the Revolutionary War, and Washington's head of the War Committee that is dealing with it. So they went way back, and then of course they went forward, and that's what ties in here. They went forward to the Constitutional Convention together, the two most prominent delegates at the time, both with a great interest, needless to say, Washington, but also Franklin, both with a big interest in the designing the presidency.
And the reason I mentioned you really underline this, that you how different they are. I mean, they were friends, but you know, Franklin's this abolitionist free thinker from the urban North, Washington, slaveholding general from the agrarian South, and yet they really were, as you described them, the indispensable authors of the American independence. And I think that's what makes it so timely, because it was their debate and their cooperation in Philadelphia during the Constitutional Convention that really formed the bedrock of the Constitution, including the system of checks and balances, which we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, they were different in those ways, and that's probably why people don't think of them together. Mm-hmm. But of course, they were all larger than life. They were already legendary, the two of them, the most famous Americans by the time of the Constitutional Convention. They had a long history together. And I don't think the Constitution would have made it. It was close as it was without their support. And they brought their differing ideas. They both had this this authority, and they respected each other. So they, the very when Washington came up to the Constitutional Convention, the first thing he did, he got there, of course, before it began. The first thing he did after he dropped his bag off at Robert Morris's house was to go down to Franklin's house and meet with Franklin. And then he was back there a couple more times for dinner in the next couple weeks. So they and there were other meetings as well. So we know they knew they needed each other. They respected each other's intelligence. They had even though one you'd probably call right of center, Washington, and the other left of center, Franklin, they both, and this is where they're so different than people today, they both, in all their meetings, whatever they did, they both spoke, they listened more than they spoke, they always listened to others, they both had an instinctive desire to compromise on means to get to the ends. They both had strong principles and beliefs and ends. And so these were the sort of people that could work together. And of course, you look over American history, we've had a lot of times when people with somewhat different views have collegially be able to work together. I think you see it famously in Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. They were able to, even though they had different views, they could work together.
Well, and this is what makes this, I hope this makes this conversation so interesting, because we can go back and forth between what the founders envisioned and what they created and what they valued and the moment that we're in right now. Now, the terms separation of powers and checks and balances don't actually appear in the Constitution, but you argue that they are central to understanding the American system of government. And so how did the founders, including Franklin and Washington, conceive of the principle of the separation of powers, and what might they think about what's happening now?
And here, of course, you need to, it's crucial to also work in James Madison and Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton and a few others, Gouverneur Morris maybe and Wilson, because James Wilson, because they were younger. And they certainly were close advisors of these people and worked closely with Washington and Franklin. There was this notion back then, there was this idea back then. The problem was the whole world back then was controlled by monarchies or some sort of authoritarian rule. There were very few republics, as it were, and those that were places like Venice and Switzerland. They weren't continental, they were local places. So here they were trying to get a continental republic, and they had suffered under the tyrannical rule of George III. If the play Hamilton gets anything right, it gets that right. And it's a wonderful play, but it this tyrannical rule, and they didn't want that. They wanted, as Washington says in his original inaugural address, we want a government of the people. And how do you create that? And the theory that Hamilton and Madison clearly articulate in the Federalist Papers, which, by the way, Washington invited them to write and thought were the greatest account of what the Constitution's meaning was, and it's all through the Federalist Papers, is what we created was a system of checks and balances so that we have the Congress and the presidency checking and balancing each other. Because if we give all power to any one entity, whether it be a legislature, and their point of reference back then was the Rhode Island legislature, which had all power and was taking away property rights and was going off the rails, or to a single man, a single person, and their notion there, of course, they could look just up close at George III, you're going to end up with, as Madison put it, the very definition of tyranny. Mm. It will happen. And so we need to check and balance these powers against each other. So, and this is where Washington and Franklin were completely aligned. The goal was individual liberty. There were others would say that too, but they were so clear what their goal was, what they wouldn't compromise on. They would compromise on means. How do we get to a government that preserves individual liberty and property rights?
You wrote in the Bulwark last week about separation of powers. No principle was more valued by them. None should be more sacred today The separation of powers is the bulwark of our freedom. And yet it appears to be regarded with almost complete indifference, at least at the moment. And you looked at what's happening right now, a couple of incidents, including the president's refusal to cooperate in any way with the impeachment proceedings, providing any witnesses or any documents, which has never happened before in history. His executive order on the budget on the wall, you know, despite Congress's refusal to appropriate the money. And you ask this question, how could the president repeatedly flout Congress? Shouldn't denial of Congress's core power of oversight and impeachment insult the pride and honor of every legislator? Didn't the Supreme Court already rule that executive privilege wasn't a sufficient defense against impeachment in U.S. versus Nixon? And then going on to the fundamental constitutional power of the person. So how did we get here? How do we start from this being the fundamental principle, the bulwark of freedom written in the Constitution, to this moment where the president seems to, without much check, you know, just override these checks?
Well, Franklin certainly saw it coming. Franklin was a voice for a more was a voice at the Constitution Convention. A couple areas he and Washington were right on board. Their main fundamental thing they were on board on, if people want to get to that, is the powers that should be in the central government versus, because they both believed in a unified central government with the states controlling local or individual matters. Now, where they differed, though, the primary difference was the power of the presidency. Now, Franklin had seen it up close, living in France, living in England for many years, watching a monarchy and a way a monarch works and a way they get corrupted. And so he, joining some other key people at the convention, most famously probably George Mason, maybe Edmund Randolph, those would be two examples, Elder Burge Gerry, who becomes governor, later vice president, governor of Massachusetts. These are big names, and they were fighting for a weaker presidency. Washington always pushed for a stronger presidency, mm-hmm. because he had the experience of the military, and you need a strong leader. And so they battle over this constantly, and it turns out that every other one of the group that is for a weaker presidency bolts and votes against the Constitution, whether in Philadelphia. And the only one who doesn't break was Franklin. Franklin ends up voting for it, and he says very clearly in his famous last speech, the last speech given by anyone, he gets up and he says, look, I'm going to vote for this. I have my problems. And he says, but it will be governed well as long as we have a man of virtue in there, a person of virtue. As it will be governed well under Washington. I know him. This Constitution will be a vehicle for the good. In the end, when the people accept it, it will lead to tyranny. He predicted it. He said it'll happen under the wrong hands because he had pushed, and he got some of these things. He pushed for impeachment. He pushed for a veto override. He pushed for these things, and he gets some of them. But he always – originally the Virginia Plan, as drafted and submitted by Edmund Randolph, called for a president who was picked by the Congress, more like that was the original plan. It only flips in the end to independently elected president. And that's when they begin to worry that there's too much power here. He can run amok. The reason why they thought impeachment would have been a check back then, and why it has not worked more recently, was because they, and this is, if they had anyone failing, their failing was as a group. It was an amazing document they produced, but they had no concept of national political parties. They set up a system without any notion that this would become a partisan government. They know about contested elections. Both Franklin and Washington had been elected to their respective state legislatures many, many times. Both of them had lost, both at least once, and they knew how competitive elections work. So did everybody else. But they thought they would be two individuals, and the people would be struggling. Which person best represents me, our district, not who's – I'm voting for this person because he's a Republican, I'm voting this person because he's a Democrat. So, and on top of that, they gave the indictment power to the House. They gave the conviction power to the Senate because the Senate wasn't elected at all. The Senate back then was like the old Confederation Congress. That's what it was modeled at. The senators were appointed by the state legislatures, and they thought they would represent the states. So what they were envisioning was a Senate, because they thought the divisions, this was the South, the agrarian slaveholding South, the farming middle states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Yes, it was a small farming state back then, not an industrial state. And then the shipping north, the trading, northern New England, we call it, and maybe into New England. So they thought, and then they thought there will be states from the West and they will be frontier states. So they thought there were three and there'd be four regions, and they thought the senators would align to their region. And so their whole idea was they had no political ties. These are appointed members, an elite members from every state representing their state interests. So how you do is they could be neutral judges. That's why they get to confirm the Supreme Court judges. That's why they get to confirm ambassadors. That's why they get certain powers that the House doesn't have. It's sort of an elite advisory body. And they figured how impeachment would be is, sure, they could be, they wouldn't be tied to a party. And they'd each, and the only reason way you'd get a conviction, since it required the supermajority, would be if you had two of the three regions, or all the regions, agreeing this guy was corrupt. And they talked about the areas of corruption. It was foreign influence.
I want to get to that in a moment. But I mean, so many things have gone wrong, have changed. You mentioned that many of the people who had been really the most suspicious of a strong executive eventually bolted and joined with the anti-federalists. And I've read some of the documents of the anti-federalists, and this feels like I'm about to utter a heresy, but to a large extent, their warnings were on target, weren't they? I mean, they've been ignored now by history, but many of their concerns were prescient, weren't they?
They were. I mean, these anti-federalists, and they run the range. Actually, if you go back to them and try to throw them forward, they would be the further left and further right. They're not all right wing. They're not all left wing. They'd be sort of like if you combine today Bernie Sanders on one end and I guess Rand Paul on the other or something. And they both looked at it, and I think they would have included both Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul. They would have looked at it and they said, this is just too much power to trust on these people. And they backed off, and many of them, some of them were extraordinarily important, and they included the future president, James Monroe. They included the future vice president, Ann Elderbridge Gerry, and the future vice president, Governor Clinton of New York. And these people, of course, famously Patrick Henry, these people had concerns, but where they agreed, where they all agreed, is they believed in liberty, but so did the supporters of the Constitution. Washington and ultimately Franklin, these people, their goal was individual liberty, and they differed of would this be a means. And what Franklin saw, and it could have happened before, somebody like an Aaron Burr taking over. And that's why Hamilton, who was from was so exercised, so involved in trying to prevent Aaron Burr from getting the presidency in the election of 1800, which I deal with in the book Magnificent Catastrophe. He said, even though Hamilton was the extreme example of a Federalist, strong federal power, centralized government, he was as far right as you could get without being so far right he was an anti-Federalist, that he is the extreme Federalist. He founds the Federalist Party. Yet his goal always was individual liberty. And he said, this guy will become a tyrant. It's his only goal. And if he gets the presidency, nobody knew the powers in the Constitution better than Madison and Hamilton, because they ended up writing, along with Gouverneur Morris and James Wilson, they ended up writing most of the nuts and bolts. Washington and Franklin had the broad vision. They were the nuts and bolts, and they knew how it could be corrupted.
And they also understood the dangers of an unprincipled demagogue sitting in that position. And so that's a very interesting historical analogy, because Hamilton was prepared to sacrifice many of his principles and his party's loyalty in order to keep out this unprincipled demagogue, Aaron Burr, and became key to having his arch rival elected president.
In the end, he gave up his life because he tried to shoot him.
You know, so many things, when we're talking about the things that they were counting on, they were counting on the Congress, our politics not being quite so tribal. And they were also counting on Congress to have a certain jealousy and not ceding all of the power to the executive. And one thing that really strikes me is that right now, neither, I'm going to be accused of, both sidesism, but neither political party seems particularly committed to restoring the checks and balances, or they're only interested in it when the other party is in power. And because you watch the political debates, and now even the Democratic candidates for president really are acting as if, the president can enact all of these massive programs. So you point out that this latest brood of politicians who seem to value partisanship and point scoring over principle and propriety, America today seems to overflow with demagogues with no statesmen for ballast. And that's one of those oof moments when I read that, because I think that's kind of the moment that we are at right now.
The graphic way you paint it, and I can't totally disagree with you, is so depressing. And that's why I think some of us are hungering for someone who isn't that way, because I do think there are people even today who put some sense of principle above this tribalism. But I think there's a lot to what you say, and you look at it, and if I was – well, I am a historian. I was going to say if I was a historian, I'd try to line it up. I see George W. Bush, who I think was a nice fellow and all, but because of his advisors, for whatever the reason, he goes overboard on executive power to push his war in Iraq. And then I have to, agree that President Obama gets in there, and whatever virtues he has, whatever tradition he has as a constitutional law professor at Chicago, in the end, pushing those after he loses the Senate, supermajority in the Senate, pushing some of those things in the Affordable Care Act through, some of his executive opinions just went off beyond what I thought was within a normal realm, and then building on it. It's like it's a three-step process. Of course, there are things in the back. Of course, Roosevelt did things and Johnson did things, but then you get to somebody like the current president, and it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you mentioned the example of taking money, appropriated money, after Congress decides not, gives him a certain amount of money on his border wall, he just takes it from a different area. That sort of activity to push his pet projects, whether it be now war powers or completely refusing to send things down, reflects a person who has or an administration that doesn't have any concept of what the framers decided would be the proper balance, and then using these tools in the Constitution the way that they feared Aaron Burr would, or the ways, in a way, in the past Andrew Jackson Andrew Johnson did, that led to his impeachment. You get to the issue that, yeah, this is where we're at, and how do we get back there, except the people, what Franklin would say is, ultimately, it's the virtue of the people, and the people have to decide to put a person of virtue in there. He would always use the term, he was a big believer in civic virtue, as was Washington. And that's what they'd say, because you hit it with your second one. I really want to emphasize, so nobody misses it. You said there were two reasons why we got to here, and it was the tribalism, but then this sense that's all that controls, and that we don't care about this. We just care about our ultimate power. And then the two, they truly believed that even if the virtue is gone, even if Franklin and Washington, who deeply believed we can't do it without Republican virtue, you'd have much more cynical people. Hamilton and Madison were much more cynical, but they had your second one. And the second one was they believed the institutional power, this quest for power, is the Senate and the House, the legislature would want their own power, and they would fight the president for power. And with the partisanship, we don't see that one. So we don't even see the backup.
See, I'm not disagreeing about the need for civic virtue, because that's obviously central, but also just a certain amount of prudence. And this is the part that I find remarkable, that when President Trump decided he was going to issue that emergency order, there were a lot of people who sort of raised their hands and said, do you understand that if you do this and you set this precedent, what is the opposition then going to be when a President Bernie Sanders or President Elizabeth Warren uses the similar powers to declare a national emergency for, I don't know, for healthcare or for the environment? That one of the things that might have restrained, and I think that the framers, you tell, correct me if I'm wrong, were hoping that would restrain some of this excessive use of power, was the understanding that people on the other side might use that kind of power. That if I do this, I will set off this cycle. And we are now in this cycle where, you know, Barack Obama uses the pen and the phone, which then empowers President Trump to be able to issue the executive orders. And once the Republican Party ceases to be in opposition to excessive use of executive power, what are Republicans going to say when Democrats ride roughshod over the checks and balances? So there's a lack of civic virtue, but also just a lack of basic prudence, isn't there?
And that's why I think that one reason why the people reacted, let's go back in time. You said the first person you cited was George W. Bush and some of the Iraq War stuff and the Guantanamo. And the people reacted by, even though I don't think it had become more liberal, reacted by putting the Democrats in charge of both the House and a supermajority in the Senate to try to balance it off. This sort of gut feeling, we need to balance off the one versus the other because the one is just going too far. But here, now we're into that second problem that if both sides have gotten so tribal, if both sides have lost this virtue part and do it, then the people are forced in the position of going back and forth between two and just getting it from the other side. And the closest thing to a result is split power. But we're seeing if a president is really determined, then you really need to give both the House and the Senate to the same other party, because one house can't, as long as the two houses of Congress are split, they can't check the president. I remember one time in that respect, I remember one time shortly before he died, I happened to have lunch with Justice Scalia. And we were talking about the power of the presidency, and he'd asked me, well, you'd read in the Washington book, what do you think the Constitution got wrong? And I said, you know, in the end, I think that they made too strong a presidency. And this was, of course, before Trump was in power. And he said, yeah, but you know, if that 1,000-pound gorilla at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue got its act together, it could take back the power. And I assume by the other end, he wasn't referring to the Supreme Court. Right. I assume he was referring to Congress. And that's right. But the trouble is, the only way they can take back that power is if they get their act together. And as long as they're divided by partisanship, they can't get their act together.
Let's talk about impeachment for a moment, because, of course, as you write in the Constitutional Convention, there was a lot of disagreement over that issue. There were a lot of folks in that convention that thought that the only check on presidential misconduct should be an election. But it was George Mason who said, shall any man be above justice? Above all, shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice? So right from the beginning, this concept of being above the law was broached. And as you point out, Ben Franklin was a supporter of impeachment. I thought it was interesting that Franklin, Madison, and Mason all talked about the need for impeachment to combat specifically foreign influence and election fraud.
Those were in the end the two things that seemed most problematic, and they had their on foreign influence. They had in mind specifically that that King Charles II had sold out for private compensation from the King of France to declare war on the Netherlands, which had been a traditional ally. And in fact, his sister was the queen of the Netherlands, or whatever title she officially gets with that at the time. And yet for a payment from France, he back then the well, sort of like it's back today. Back then, the King of England had sole power to declare war. He didn't have to go to Parliament to declare war. He had to go to Parliament to get funds for war, but not to declare it and go to war with any existing funds he had. Now, of course, we worry that the president here has taken that power over. And so he and that was one, that was the foreign influence one. And then, but still they don't have the votes. And what convinces them, originally it wasn't, the president wasn't to be elected by, under the original Virginia plan, he was picked by Congress. But it was only after they moved to this electoral system where you have the electors voting the presidency that they get enough, they get a majority for the impeachment, because they bring over some of them who had been opposed to it before, like Gouverneur Morris, get up there and he says, well, wait a minute, there could be a corrupt election, because they could be buying off these electors, and then we'd need an impeachment to overturn a corrupt election. And so you're absolutely right. The two driving forces, other things could go wrong. They others mentioned just a criminal, you know, the president does starts doing criminal acts. But beyond that, the two major concerns were foreign influence, that we get a president who is bought off, has got a 4-year term, is bought off by a foreign power, or ones that got we discover afterwards was elected in a fraudulent or corrupt means.
You mentioned, by the way, just sort of in passing, war powers. We're having a big debate about whether or not Congress should reassert its war powers. What do you think that the founders would have thought about the kinds of issues that we're dealing with in terms of the power of the president to bomb other countries, invade other countries without congressional approval? Because, of course, this is the tension between Article 1 and Article 2. You know, Congress has the power to declare war, but the president is the commander in chief. Did they recognize, or did they anticipate that there would be this kind of tension?
Certainly they did, because they were looking over to England and to France and to Europe, where the monarch had sole power to declare war. And they did not want that. They thought about it, and the original draft of the Virginia Plan gives all executive power. So that would include all the traditional executive powers. That's what else could they be thinking about? All the powers of the king they give to the executive branch. They didn't call it the president yet, but what we would call the president. And then they start pulling them back. They said, this is too much. And so they start pulling them back, and they pull back the war power. And then they say, and the original way they pull it back is a little too broad. And they figured, well, this guy, Congress might not be in session and we get invaded. We've got to be able to repel invasion. So then they change it to the power to declare war and said, well, this way he'll be able to repel an attack, but he has to wait for Congress to initiate one. So when you see this play out, you see Washington and Adams and Madison. All as president, and Madison, of course, was key in drafting, was one of the key people in drafting the Constitution. They all used their powers to in a sense repel attacks, whether they be from the Spanish or in the frontier or the Native Americans. It depends on the attacks on the high seas in the case of John Adams. But they think they need to go to Congress if they want to assert something. And so Adams goes to Congress to get permission to attack British or French vessels in the high seas. We can repel them, but if we need to attack them because they're attacking us, we need to attack them back. And then when the War of 1812 comes, Madison thinks, I can do a whole bunch of things on the border, but if we want to go to war with England, We need, even though they're attacking us in various ways, either in the high seas or on the border, or supplying guns to the Indians on the frontier, we've got to get a declaration from Congress. And so they thought about how that balance works, and they had been there, and so that balance pretty well stays in control until really very recent times, because it's hard to think of anything that exceeds defensive action. You see defensive action, but affirmative action, whether you're – and then the question comes down on an individual case. Okay, take, for example, the recent example of the missiles that kill the Iranian leader. Is that a defensive action? Well, it is if he's planning an imminent attack. And that's why you see some of the president's advisors going before Congress or going on the talk shows and saying, we have definite evidence of an imminent attack. That's why they're pushing that word imminent, because they're trying to fall within this exception. But if they don't have imminent, if this is an affirmative act to, because he's not a non-state actor like an actor for Al Qaeda, he's a military leader of a set. Is it an affirmative act of war? And that's the balance that these people going before Congress, or people who are testifying, or people, what evidence do we have here? It makes it, what they're doing is they're playing with this thing that goes back to the Constitution.
It is fundamental. So the book went on sale just a couple of days ago, Franklin and Washington, the Founding Partnership, by Pulitzer Prize winner Edward Larson, one of USA Today's must-read books of the winter. Publishers Weekly named it one of the top 10 most anticipated memoirs and biographies. You got a starred review in Booklist, which says Larson brings together the lives of these titans, showing how their backgrounds and joint interests made them ideal partners and inspired approach for considering the lives and legacies of these two founding fathers. And once again, the history seems very, very current, very timely, very relevant. Edward Larson, thank you so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast today.
It's been tremendous talking with you. I hope we can do it again.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.